it can be triggered by someone kind of like insinuating that I don't know something because I don't have a PhD. And those kind of moments of like, it's hard not to take that personally, but I do try to remind myself that's, I'm doing what I can do with the tools that I have.
This is Finding the Throughline, the show that gives you inside access to honest conversations about the creative process. I'm Kate Hanley. Today's guest is novelist and essayist Joanne McNeil. Joanne is the author of the novel Wrong Way, about a gig worker for a tech company that makes driverless cars, and many essays about technology. Today, I'm talking with Joanne about what I call inner stuff, the thoughts, ideas, and attitudes that affect your work, even if you're not fully conscious of it. Joanne, is creating your work and then sharing that work, so it's two sides of the same coin, but it's all one package, right? Does that come easily to you? Like, what's your favorite part about it?
It really depends on what the work is. I mean, with a nonfiction work, I think that comes from kind of like the asshole in me who loves to be right. I think there's just like that part of me who loves to win an argument, loves to show up and have all the facts. And I might sometimes pretend I don't, but I do love to be right. And that, so when I write an op-ed, I am often very excited to share it. I'm often very excited to have the debates, especially if I did something tricky there where I might lead someone into thinking that I'm about to go somewhere that I'm definitely not.
Uh-huh.
That's one part of my writing practice. And in a way, I'd say like the nonfiction is a good way to get that out in the nonfiction, because you don't win at writing novel. There's no winning there. I mean, some might argue with me, like they might say that there is a way to write in a way that would result in awards, that would result in certain kind of prestige. And I think there is some element to that. And I think it can be gamed in a way, but I ultimately, your own self-worth isn't like, you don't have the same kind of sense of an argument to win, or there is a position that's, you're either right or wrong. And so with writing fiction, my insecurity does come in there. And this book in particular, Wrong Way, it came out very, very quietly. I did not share this work with many people. I shared it with my agent and my editor, and they were two of maybe I could count on one hand how many people had seen the manuscript at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
I really was, you know, until my editor went ahead with it, I wasn't really sure that anyone was taking me seriously. I mean, I was kind of like, it was a new space for me in that, although it isn't autobiographical, it is sharing something of kind of my imagination, it's sharing a sense of me that's not quite as guarded as I can be in an op-ed way. Now, I would say the essay form is kind of a blend of both, and lurking in many ways was very personal work of nonfiction. There are elements of memoir in there. And I was kind of nervous about that too. I kind of had, I think the version that earlier drafts were a little bit more argumentative and maybe had a little bit more bluster. And as I felt more comfortable with and more trusting of the people I was working with, I started being a little bit more reflective and offering more of myself. I think all of this could change based on the book too. Like, of course, there's the memoir form, but there's also nonfiction that you can write that is personal in ways that no one outside of the people close to you could ever understand. It might be a theme or a topic or an event that you have a real strong connection to. And putting that connection in the text might not necessarily help. So it's like there are variations here, and there might be elements of fiction that you can distance yourself from. I've had a few experiences drafting screenplays with people that, by nature of being collaborative, I don't have that same sense of ownership of. I mean, it all varies, but I will say that I feel very grateful that I've been able to have this experience of working with people that I trust and trusting that they are seeing my work and accepting it.
Yeah. Is there any part that really just gives you what I call the heebie-jeebies? Like, you know, it's coming up and you just want to go in bed and not come out.
If I'm understanding you right, like parts of the writing that are kind of, you yeah, really don't want to.
Yeah. Any part of the process.
Well, I will say for Wrong Way, this book, in terms of structure, it is the story of a woman's life told through the work environments she has been present in. So already a typical story of someone's life would be told through your closest family or friends or relationships that you've had. This is told through spaces where the people she is surrounded by are forever alien to her because, you know, you have that job, you leave it, and those people go back to being strangers again. Mm-hmm. So I had that, like, I knew that's what I was doing. And as I was working on this book, it occurred to me, like, I can't write a book about women in the workplace, because that's, among other things, that is what it is. I can't write a book about women in the workplace without including elements of sexual harassment. It's just not authentic. It's not authentic to my experience. Mm-hmm. And I really did not like having to draft the scenes of suggesting sexual violence, suggesting that in many cases, quite clearly a case of sexual harassment at work. I didn't want to do that. Based on, you know, it's just, these aren't memories that I really want to go back to in my mind. That's not what I want to mind when I'm working. Mm-hmm. But I realized that this is what the work as I needed to be, it needed those scenes. And mm-hmm. I kind of got over it. I think what really helped is, you know, I kind of wrote them in a flurry, and somewhere in third or fourth or fifth time revising the draft, I could figure out how to get them more seamless, and I could have like a little bit of distance between what I wrote and that moment of frustration. And in the revision process, I could bring it more so that it would feel more seamless in the text. And like, I didn't have the anxiety writing it.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things does your inner critic love to tell you? Like, I think we all have similar themes, but I find that there's often like an interesting slant on it. And it's so helpful to hear, because usually we're just subject to it on our own in our own heads. And we think like no one else is thinking this kind of thing. So.
I would say that because, you know, I wasn't a good student, and that wasn't something I wanted to really pursue at any time in my life. I never really thought I'd get a master's degree, let alone a PhD. But every once in a while, that insecurity sets in for me, because a lot of people in publishing and literary circles have advanced degrees, are very serious about their reading. And I am, if anything, I try to overcompensate, and I definitely read a lot. But there are times that I have a sense like my lack of formal education is holding me back.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, that insecurity has led me to really advocate for other people who maybe dropped out of school or just did not have that path, because it can really hold you back. And I want to, in some ways, embrace that part of me. But yes, it also does lead to a lot of insecurity in many circumstances.
Yeah. And when that insecurity is cropping up, how do you deal with it?
I think just being aware of it and not trying to ever overcompensate in a one-on-one situation, but to just note. And also, it can be triggered by someone kind of like insinuating that I don't know something because I don't have a PhD. And those kind of moments of like, it's hard not to take that personally, but I do try to remind myself that's I'm doing what I can do with the tools that I have. And I can't write a white paper the way that a PhD in a subject would, but there are people out there who can do that with the tools that they have. But the essays I write, my writing as an essayist clearly shows that I'm working from outside of the academy and what writing can do without that background as well.
Yeah.
How old are you, and how do you feel your age affects your work reality, just what you're up to and your strategies?
Well, I'm 43 and I'm not a young writer. And I think about this a lot because I also think I'm still an emerging voice. Like, I think I'm an emerging writer because in my 20s, I wouldn't have had any idea how to get an agent. I wouldn't have had any idea how to get published. It wasn't until my 30s that these things snapped together for me. I don't mind people knowing my age, but I do think sometimes the conversation about writers and experience is, it's coming from a place expecting everyone to have the same kind of graduated from Yale, went to Iowa by 28, has an agent, publishes the book by 31. That's possible for only a certain type of writer. And if we want writing to be expansive, if we want the form of the novel to be changing and evolving with time, we need people who have gotten into writing in different ways. And often that will be slower because the professional track isn't clear to you. So, like, I think there are many reasons why women writers especially emerge later. Some are things like, you know, if you have kids at the age of 32, you know, like, it's at any age, if you have children, if you have responsibilities, if you're caring for aging parents, you might have a lot of responsibilities that just don't make it easy for you to finish whatever work you would like to accomplish. And that could be why a writer is emerging in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, or 70s. And I think that the reason I use the word emerging is because I don't feel like I'm quite at that mid-career stage as a writer. I don't quite have that sense of being secure enough to look back at this broad, in terms of books, I mean, I have two books, so I'm emerging as an author. As a tech critic, I guess I'm mid-career, but as an author, I'm emerging. And I know there's Joe Walsh in Ireland who has a lot of commentary on this, that when we have prizes that have age limits, it's basically immediately cutting out the possibility of someone who just, for many good reasons, cannot get that book out by the age of 29 or so. And yeah, I obviously have a lot to say about this, but I think much about the way I write has, like, there are things that have deepened, but I think there's something really core to the way I work that my writing, when I look at something I wrote even 15 years ago, I still see myself in it. So there's something kind of core that maybe I'm much more in control of and aware of, but that myself has been consistent.
Yeah. Are there ways that you feel out of step with your peer group?
Not really, because I have a really broad peer group. This is something I really try to do, is I do have a lot of friends who are much older than me. I have a lot of friends who are younger than me. And it's something that I value a great deal. And I work very hard to maintain these friendships because I value conversations about creativity, about creation of work. I mean, I value the process of being an artist, of being a writer. And that right now is a, for many times we all know about, it feels like a not easy time to do this work. So having the community, going to the gallery openings, even when I would much rather be in my pajamas and watch TV, I feel like this is a pretty big part of that struggle to maintain what is powerful about the arts. I need to be present for it. I need to be present for my friends. If there's a book launch for a friend's book, I'm going to make sure that I'm there. If there's a gallery opening for one of my friends' work, I'm going to make sure I'm there because I really believe in art and that we need to make it happen. And we need to make sure that it's still there.
Yeah. So this is an opportunity to get up on your soapbox if you would like to. Are there collective illusions that you wish we would wake up from that are just like really present to you personally?
I guess this is kind of getting to be a cliche now, but I do feel a little frustrated by this past year of discourse around AI art and just Now I think actual tools of machine learning can be very interesting. I wrote this piece for Filmmaker magazine about an artist who creates their own training data and is not just like slurping everything off the internet. And on the other hand, a lot of what people imagine AI can do, the enthusiasts, which I would argue it really isn't doing, but even if it did, it feels very hostile to the process, to the having intentions as an artist, to the work of making art, which is where humans connect to one another. I love books. I love art because among other elements, not just the entertainment or the novelty, but you have this connection with the artist in a diffused way that someone might write a novel hundreds of years ago and you can receive it. And maybe you're receiving it imperfectly. Maybe you're not understanding the full extent of their intentions, but you're receiving something and you're receiving that humanity. At this point, I do worry about it being cliche because, like, there is something so corny about, you know, raising your hand and being like, I speak for the humans. I'm here for the humanity and the human spirit. But at the same time, like, we've gotten to such a craven moment that we have to have these like corny statements like, yes, humanity is important. How did we get to that point? I follow this stuff and I'm still baffled that it got to be such an extreme that the cost cutting and the bizarro ways in allegedly in the name of efficiency, all of that is so strikingly cynical to me. And if I need to be this cheesy romantic who says, yes, humanity is important, then so be it.
Well, I think if you were going to write a screenplay about this moment, you would need that character, right? So maybe you're just being that character in service of the story and humanity. So thank you so much for sharing these answers with us, Joanne. That wraps up our questions on the inner parts of the creative process. And I'm looking forward to getting a preview of what's coming up for you and hearing about like what you're staying up too late reading and watching. I want to thank our listeners for being here today and stay tuned for a little sneak peek of Friday's episode. It's going to roll after the end of the credits. All right. Talk to you on Friday. Finding the Throughline airs one interview per week, broken up into three episodes that come out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free. Skip the ads and get each interview in one longer episode by becoming a paid subscriber at katehanley.substack.com. Even if you aren't ready to get out your wallet just yet, become a free subscriber at katehanley.substack.com and receive the full show notes with links to everything my guests and I cover. However you listen, thank you. Finding the Throughline is edited by Sound Advice Strategies. Connect with me on Instagram at katehanleyauthor. Here's a little preview of what's to come in part 3 of this interview.
I don't really believe avant-garde, radical politics, any of that is outside the interests of someone who lives in a normal, allegedly normal suburban life. I think, in fact, like the kind of new forms that we're seeing on TV and A24 movies are showing that like people who aren't just kind of elite city dwellers are looking to be challenged by work.
I'm Kate Hanley, and this is Finding the Throughline. More to come on Friday.